Jackson, Barry W. Jackson, since there are two Barry Jacksons in Alaska. I was born in Long Branch, New Jersey on January 27, 1930. My early education was grade schools in New York, Long Island, Florida, especially near Miami, finally California near San Diego in Del Mar. I went to San Diego Union High School, graduating in 1947. I went to Stanford, majoring in political science, graduating in 1952 under the Navy ROTC program. I obtained a commission as a Marine Corps officer, spent almost 3 years in the Marine Corps, returned to Stanford after a brief summer introductory session to law school at George Washington in Washington, D.C. Spent 3 years in law school at Stanford and came to Alaska initially during my senior year in law school in September 1957. Looking over Anchorage and Fairbanks, and returned after graduation in late December 1957, arriving in Fairbanks on the 10th of February 1958. I've lived in Fairbanks ever since.
Was your family with the military? Is that why you were?
My father was, in his early years, was a naval aviator. He had gone to Harvard and got into a naval aviation program, and he was a pilot, naval aviator on the USS Saratoga, which was based in San Diego, which is where he met my mother.
How many children are in your family, your immediate family?
I have five children, four daughters.
No, I meant in your brothers and sisters.
Brothers and sisters, I have one brother and a sister, both younger, and a younger half-brother and half-sister. Mm-hmm. My half-brother lives here in Fairbanks, and my sister lives here in Fairbanks. They both came up here after I came to Fairbanks.
Are any of them lawyers?
There are no lawyers in my family since a great-uncle, who was an admiralty lawyer in San Francisco. He's notable because he went to law school when he was in his 40s, and he had four or five children at the time.
Why did you go to law school?
Well, I always dreamed of law, but I suppose my real motivation was that I wanted to get into politics, and I wanted a profession that I could combine with an avocation in politics, and which I would be happy doing regardless of the outcome in politics.
Have you found law to be that way?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of practice can you have and still go in and out of politics?
I found that is difficult. In Fairbanks, at least, clients don't want lawyers who serve in the legislature. They don't need political influence, and they don't want to be paying for an attorney who's spending time in the legislature or time in politics. They want an attorney who's going to tend to their business. So while I've been able to spend time in the legislature, the combination of politics and law was not, you didn't make any money at it. You lost money at it.
Did it hurt? Were lawyers dissuaded from going into politics because they have to disclose who their clients are? Do you think that has dissuaded some lawyers?
When I first started running for office, that was not a serious problem.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a problem at all. Subsequent to my declining to run, I served two terms in the state legislature, and both times I declined to run for re-election. Since the second time, I'm convinced that the disclosure laws are so onerous that they discourage lawyers from filing for public office. And I don't see a real need for it. If I've got a client who's paying me, oh, let's say $500 a month, I can see a need to disclose that. But the idea that somebody who pays you more than $100 in 1 year has to have his name spread out as a matter of public record that they came to see you is going to be inhibiting. And my practice is a bankruptcy practice. 70% of my work is in bankruptcy. So most of the people who come to see me are contemplating bankruptcy. How can I run for public office now and then spread across the public record that so-and-so came to see me and spent $300 with me for legal services and I helped him avoid bankruptcy, but now people are going to suspect that he came to see me because he was contemplating filing bankruptcy.
Yeah. Why did you decide to look at Alaska?
Well, first of all, I was fighting for the middle of my class, and in those days at Stanford, if you didn't get in the top 5% or at least 10% of your class, you didn't have real employment opportunities. The idea of working for a large firm did not really appeal to me in the first place. The second choice for many of us would have been going to work for the government, but already at that time I had a deep distaste for working in the bureaucracy.
Why?
I had already decided that I was very much of a liberal, even a radical, when I was in high school. But during high school, I decided that the difference between the United States and a communist system was that in a communist system or a totalitarian system, there was a single hierarchy. There was a single group of institutions all leading up to the head, and if you didn't make it where you were, you had no possibility of a lateral transfer to another institution or another group. And government has that problem. And since then, I've picked up a lot of other things, including the bureaucratic imperative, the tendency of any bureaucracy to pick up jurisdiction. Yes, we will try and help you as long as you don't get well, because if you get well, then I don't have a justification for my job. The lack of tying rewards in the bureaucracy to productivity. I'd spent 3 years in the Marine Corps as an officer, which I was delighted. I had some difficult times. I lost my security clearance because I thought that the Russians were making more use of the talent of women than America was, and we could learn something from that. It was probably the best bureaucratic institution that I've ever come across. I still had problems. In law school, I knew I didn't want to get back into a bureaucratic institution. I might be willing to do it at the local government level, but not at the federal level.
What about a legislature? The state legislature, don't you have to deal with the bureaucracy?
Yes, you have to deal with the bureaucracy, but you are theoretically on top, except, of course, you're only down in Juneau for 90 days or 105 days or longer now, and the bureaucracy breathes a sigh of relief as soon as the legislature goes home, because then they can go do what they think is in the public interest, and they are not really accountable to anyone. They don't have to answer to anyone, because there's no way that the accountability system within the executive structure from the governor on down can adequately oversee everything that goes on at the lower levels.
Boy, I tell you one thing, I'm not sure
that I could have you in that. So that's your distaste for your bureaucracy.
Now, I did serve 3.5 years as city attorney.
Yeah.
But then I was serving directly at the pleasure of the city council, and all I had to do was satisfy them. And I was working on a very close, every week we had a meeting, and we had work sessions from time to time. And I stayed with it until finally we got a mayor, Darrell Brewington, who tended to be an autocrat, even though under the city charter he had no right to be. And eventually it became unpleasant to work under that sort of a personality.
So back to why you came to Alaska, you couldn't work in a large firm.
I wanted to be able to see my contemporaries and know, in a sense, who the other people that I was in the pond with and how I measured up and what I could do. And in a bar association as large as California, you just can't do that. And too much depends upon who you know. Too much depends upon the old families. There is limited mobility unless you are very brilliant. If you're very brilliant, there's still a lot of mobility in the United States. But I did not consider myself brilliant, although I had one of the highest averages on the LSAT test that Stanford had ever seen when I came there, but that's because I have a talent for multiple choice and true-false. The only courses I got A's in law school were the two that had true-false multiple choice.
Anyway, to be a big fish in a little pond. Is that the...
I wouldn't call it a little pond, but one where I could, where it had a human dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of not just Alaska, I thought of Hawaii, Idaho, Arizona. Mm-hmm. It just happened that I was back in the good graces of the Marine Corps, and Alaska was sort of my first choice, and the Marine Corps agreed to send me to Alaska as a reserve officer to try and establish reserve units in Alaska, knowing that I wanted to settle up here and that I was about to get out of law school. And they did, and we set up reserve units. I walked into Judge Forbes' office in 1957 in a captain's uniform. That's not how he expected his next law clerk to show up. And Doris Wilkin was there. She's now Jay Rabinowitz's law clerk, and Jay was the law clerk. He picked me up at the airport, and it was the second day. I was, for some reason that he may remember, I don't. I didn't get there on the day that we were originally scheduled to arrive.
So what did he say when he saw you in uniform?
Gee, I don't know, but I think he probably had some thoughts because he spent a year or so in the U.S. Army and had been probably a PFC and was, and as far as I'm concerned, still is somewhat anti-military and certainly anti-military bureaucracy. And to have a Marine Corps captain coming into the chambers to see Judge Forbes must have given him a little bit of pause.
What do you think, Judge Forbes? Did Judge Forbes know you were a Marine Corps captain?
I was in uniform.
When he hired you?
Oh, well, see, that was 3 months later.
Oh, you really?
I came up in September looking over Anchorage and Fairbanks, and when I came to Fairbanks, I looked into the possibility of the clerkship and did meet Forbes at that time. And we left, and I didn't know what sort of impression I'd made. But in the end of January, I was studying for the California Bar, which I ended up not taking. But he sent me a wire saying if I can be here in 10 days, I've got a job. Well, we packed and we made it. I flew up on Alaska Airlines on a converted DC-4 with cargo doors, and the cargo doors were so loose that you could see through the cracks down to the snow of southeast Alaska as we were flying up. The stewardesses wore parkas and ski pants because you had to. The heating system in the plane wasn't all that good.
Why didn't you settle in Anchorage? Did you look for jobs in Anchorage?
I looked over Anchorage. Even at that time, I felt that Anchorage was going to be too metropolitan in the worst sense. Too much. Well, I've had friends since who speak of Anchorage as lost Anchorage. To me, there was much more of a human dimension to Fairbanks, much more ease in getting to know people, and much more mobility, social and professional mobility. Even then, you could see in Anchorage the tendency to who are you and who is your family and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which I had a strong mother, powerful personality. If I'd stayed in San Diego, in the San Diego area, I would have known everybody, but everybody would have known that I was her daughter, her son. And that wasn't the way I wanted to make my way in the world.
When you got to Fairbanks, were you still Marine Corps Reserve?
Yes.
So when you were clerking, you were still, still aside?
Yeah.
How long?
I stayed in the Marine Corps Reserve until I had 20 years in. I would go outside in the summers for 2 weeks training, occasionally for once or twice for umpire duty on maneuvers. Just about 10 years ago, I was retired. I didn't get that many number of years of satisfactory federal service in, so I have no retirement pay coming ever, and no other benefits except that I'm a retired Marine major infantry. Never went into law.
Why not?
Well, first of all, when I was on active service, I was an infantry officer. I had no desire, after I got through law school, to change my MOS, military occupational specialty, to a legal officer.
Why not?
I enjoyed, if I got called back, I didn't want to be a legal officer. I wanted to be with troops. I met marvelous people in the Marine Corps and before the Marine Corps. I knew one of the owners of Club 21 in New York. I knew a lieutenant colonel who had been captured at Bataan. I knew officers who had advanced degrees in Mandarin Chinese. The colonels that I knew in the Marine Corps tended to be rather unusual people. And that was the type of person I would have wanted to be if I'd stayed in the Marine Corps. I was sort of that way, but that led to problems.
In what respect? What way were you and what problems did it lead to?
Well, first of all, I told you how I said something that led people to believe that I might be a communist. I had a period of time at Stanford University when I was on the executive committee under the then president of the student body, who is now dean of the law school at the University of Oklahoma, Wayne Alley. And as a Marine, I was not in favor of fighting unless you have to. If you can avoid war, you try to avoid war. If you have to fight, you fight. And we had an organization, a peace group on campus during the Korean War, which was about half Quaker and about half communist or crypto-communist, and we did not wish to turn them off of campus. On the other hand, we were a little bit concerned that something might happen.
I hope so.
That might be embarrassing to the student body and the university, and so I volunteered with the student body president to attend the meetings, which I was interested in doing. And if anything looked like anything might happen, it might be out of line, I'd tell him. This was not done by the university administration. It was strictly between the student body president and myself, and nobody else knew about it. Well, after I said what I said about women in Russia, the Naval Intelligence interviewed me, and I had to say what had happened, and that didn't help. That eventually got resolved after that, when I was in law school. But anyway, I also used to fly model airplanes with small engines on strings in the middle of the parade field in Nara, Japan, on Sunday morning as a second lieutenant. Well, that wasn't the sort of thing that second lieutenants are supposed to do. And in my first liberty in Japan, I went from Nara to Kyoto. We'd gotten there during a communist scare, and they were concerned that there'd be big public demonstrations after we got there. First time Marines had been in Japan since the Second World War. This is 1953. First liberty, I go to Japan. The Imperial University at Kyodai, and look up the English-speaking society. I don't know how I found them. I did, but I didn't know a word of Japanese. Ended up giving to the university 2 one-year scholarships for students at Kyodai. I gave 2 more 1-year scholarships. This is in the space of about 4 months out of my pay, to Doshisha University. Got an award from the Rotary Club in Nara for Japanese American relations. I used to get a certain amount of notoriety. Well, I had a regimental executive officer by the name of Wade Mosby Jackson. Wade Mosby Jackson was a good Southern officer, and he used to get kidded by other lieutenant colonels and majors about your namesake. Well, he made my life a little bit miserable, but I had other officers who were very supportive. I'd like one more. And they made me, of all things, Stoli on the Rocks with a twist of lemon, made me, of all things, MP officer in Nara, Japan. So I was working with an Army MP unit, working 70 hours or more a week. I had my own Jeep. I didn't have a driver. I drove it myself. I could go anywhere in town, and I knew all of the bars and the bar girls and the managers or owners of the bars that were catering to the military, primarily the Marines, in Nara. And here I was without a security clearance. How come did I get this? Well, there were other officers thought, since I don't have a security clearance and I can't see these secret plans on maneuvers and things that we're doing, this would be suitable for me to be doing. And they weren't worried about me. They just had to operate within the system. Okay. What was the question?
How did the military, and how did your attitude toward the military, I was thinking more about how it affected you once you got to Fairbanks.
Oh. Well.
Did it not?
It didn't, except that I was then and still am a loyal Marine, and appreciated very much what the Marine Corps had done. I was disappointed that I'd run into a career block because of the security clearance. On the other hand, they helped get me up here, and they gave me sort of a semi-vacation for a number of years in the sense that I could go back to San Diego or Quantico in the summers for 2 weeks, and we worked fairly hard.
But what was the reception up here to Marine Corps in the 50s and early 60s?
Well, we had a number of Marines who were Fairbanksons or who had settled here after the Korean War, and they were active in the American Legion, which I wasn't, and in many of the service clubs, Moose, Elks, Eagles, as well as, so, this is a very patriotic town. And
when you first got up here, who were the other lawyers who were practicing?
McNeely and Murdies were active, and McNabb, T.N. Gore, Charlie Cole was here. He was the first attorney I met in Fairbanks. Matter of fact, he had a major role, in my opinion, in convincing me that this is a place I ought to come.
What did he say?
It was just the way he was, and his joy in being in Fairbanks and practicing in Fairbanks.
What did he say to you?
Beyond the fact that he thought that I ought to apply, that I had a chance of being law clerk to Judge Forbes, I can't recall.
Was he really encouraging about where you could go?
He was encouraging, as a matter of fact, all the attorneys that were up here that I met. Bogus, Clasby.
You met all these people the first time you came up?
Bogus and Clasby, I think I met the first time I was here. Mm-hmm. Mary Alice Miller, I'm not sure about. Charlie Cole, definitely. McNeely and Murdies, yes. I think I met Hugh Connolly the first time I was here, but I'm not sure about that. Jay Rabinowitz, of course. George Yeager I met that September when I came up. Who else beyond that? I cannot now remember. Oh, Ledessa Nordale I think I met.
Was she the commissioner?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say the most influential one was Charlie Cole.
This is maybe impression, but that's my recollection.
Were there other
Although,
I don't know.
The reception that I got, the reception in Anchorage was good also. But I just took a look at the people up here and the reception I got and the quality of people and the talent that they appeared to have. And I was convinced this is where I was. This is where I wanted to be.
What was the reception in Anchorage like?
Good.
Who did you meet?
Wendell Kay.
If you want to talk football, I'll talk to you.
Who are the federal judges in Anchorage?
Did you see the cartoon in the paper last night?
McCary? Dale McCary? No, trying to think. Plumber. I met both of the plumbers. I may have met Fitzgerald that first trip. I'm not sure about that. I do have a distinct recollection of having met Wendell Kay in a small office off of the square where the old City Hall is.
Was he encouraging?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you get any job offers in Anchorage?
No. I didn't have a job offer at all when I left in September. And the first one I got was Forbes sent me a telegram.
You didn't wait?
My God, that was the job I wanted. I'm not going to wait for another. And when I left Fairbanks in September to fly back to finish my last quarter at Stanford, the job I wanted was to be Forbes Law Clerk.
Did you interview with J.L. McCary at all?
Cannot now recall. I may well have, or may well have met him. I probably did, but I don't have an independent recollection of it.
So when you got to Fairbanks, how long were you in with Forbes?
A year.
A year? What did you do?
Mostly legal research, legal memorandums, drafting memorandum opinions, doing instructions to juries, mostly in criminal cases.
When you were done, were there any other clerks at the time that you were a clerk?
No, just one.
Who is
it? Oh, motion practice, reviewing the motions, researching the memoranda that were submitted.
Who was the DA at the time?
George Yeager, as I recall, but I'm not sure of that, but I believe that George was U.S. attorney at that time, and for quite some time after that.
Mm-hmm. After a year in the judge's office, what did you do?
Well, my wife was a very good secretary who had worked for the counsel for the U.S. Army in the Pentagon and had been a secretary in the State Department, and she'd worked up here for the cold weather laboratory, I forget the name, at the university, Fort Wainwright.
Well, you were working in Forbes' office?
And I was working in Forbes' office, and we decided to set up my own office, and I moved into a small office across from Charlie Cole. The office is still exists across from the federal building, the post office, and set up in a small two-room office with about $2,000, I think, we had to start with, and went on from there. After 6 months, the city decided to have a full-time city attorney and put out a request for an invitation to people to apply, and I applied, and I was appointed city attorney, and I served as city attorney for 3.5 years after that.
How hard was it to start up your own practice?
Well, let's say that in 6 months I hadn't made it yet, but I was confident that I would.
Yeah. Were other lawyers in the community helping you?
Oh, yeah. Got lots of reference referrals.
Any in particular that you can say were really outstanding in there?
I can't remember any that are particularly outstanding in terms of the amount of good cases. There's a tendency for lawyers to look for the new lawyer in town, because if you don't want this and it's a dog, send him over, because he just getting, yeah, and it'll be good experience for him. So, of course, there was a certain amount of that. But I got from probably 3, 4, maybe 6 attorneys in town, cases that were good cases, that they just couldn't handle. They would have handled if they could.
Which attorney?
I can't now remember.
Any of them were firm?
No.
They were all solo practices?
Well, in those days, we didn't have any firm more than about 2 attorneys and a law clerk.
Yeah. So it wasn't
Collins and Clasby was a big firm, and that was Clasby and Mary Alice Miller.
So the firms like Collins and Clasby or McNeely and Mertius didn't set cases out there?
Oh, yes, they did.
They did?
Yeah.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know. I wanted to know if these firms that were establishing themselves had too much work and were sending work to other places. That's all. So even not just solo practitioners were sending you work.
I got work from probably every firm in town. But
when you were the city attorney, you didn't have to worry about
Yeah.
It was just,
well, I had to worry about the city's work, but
right.
I didn't have any private practice, no.
Yeah. When you finished being city attorney, what did you do?
Well, the first thing I did is reopen the office, which is in the same building where I am now, except I was just across the hall.
Uh-huh.
And within a couple of months, I ran for what is now borough mayor. And it was a 4-way race, and I came in 3rd, which surprised everybody because they thought I'd be 4th. I got about 22% of the vote, which wasn't too bad. And so I decided to continue with that. And a few months later, I ran for nomination on the Democratic Party for one of the 7 members of the State House we had at that time. I came in 7th out of 14, but that was enough to get nominated. And then I came in 2nd in the general election, and so I went to Juneau.
What year is this?
And that was 64. And I served in the 65 and 66 session as finance member of the Finance Committee. First lawyer they'd ever had on the Finance Committee since statehood.
North Pole! Oh boy. You gotta stay sober.
When did you first get involved with Native Learn?
1965.
How did you do that?
I'm sure I saw it. Dictated. Bernice
stays over.
I got
dirt
so she can
ride. William Byler was the executive director of the Association on American Indian Affairs in New York, which is a group formed, I think, by Oliver LaFarge some years earlier. It is basically a non-Indian group, white group, who were supportive of Indian problems in the country. They had become involved in trying to help Alaskan Indians, Eskimos, and Minto was a small village west of Fairbanks, about 40 some miles, maybe 80 miles. The state was selecting land around Minto, and somehow this had come to the attention of the association, and Peter John, who was the traditional chief of Minto, came into my office in 1965 with Bill Byler, and I'm thinking that Richard Frank came in at the same time, but I'm not sure. Richard Frank took over from Peter John, and were interested in having me represent them. They had been represented by Ted Stevens. Ted had been disqualified by the Department of Interior solicitor on the grounds that he'd been U.S. attorney, and therefore there was a conflict of interest. Ted, by the time that I came to Fairbanks, had pretty well left Fairbanks. So they'd been without counsel for quite some time. Ted, I think, while I was here, filed a protest to the selection of lands by the state of Alaska. But by that time, he'd moved to Anchorage, and at any rate, I agreed to represent them.
Why did they pick you?
Well, the established attorneys in Fairbanks would have been very hesitant to take on the work.
Why?
Because the idea that the Indians had rights to lands was not popular, and with some people was like anathema. And a lot of Fairbanksons had duck cabins in the Minto Flats, and so they were looking for an attorney who was not tied in to the extent that he might be hesitant about representing Minto against the state or inferentially against those who had duck cabins. And why they picked me beyond that, I don't know. But I was—I had no hesitation about taking on the work.
Was it a lot of work at the beginning? Did it take a great percentage of your time?
Well, in the sense of being like 50% of my time, no.
Mm-hmm.
5 or 10% would probably be more like it.
Uh-huh.
I went in 65, I was already in the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a meeting with Governor Egan, and I believe that Greening was there. I'd have to check my records. And Bartlett sent a representative, what should be done about the Minto lands. And at the conclusion of it, it was felt that something ought to be done about Minto lands. And I told Bill Egan, either then or shortly after, that in the coming session of 66, that I would not raise the issue politically in the legislature, but that I would expect that the administration would review the problem, and that after the legislative session was over, we would have a proposal from them. Now, we had a state landsman here in Fairbanks by the name of Joe Lawler, who had selected the state lands around Minto, but he only wanted the lands in the southern portion of the flats. Why, I'm not sure. And he also wanted to protect Minto. So he made sort of a private deal, which is in writing, that he would select the northern half of the flats by the state to make sure that the natives got it, rather than other people filing under homestead or other laws or for cabin sites. At any rate, I had felt that, based upon my contact with Joe Lawler and others at the lower level, that the state administration ought to be able to come up with a reasonable proposal on how to protect Minto, and I didn't raise the question. Well, it was a hot potato. It's like subsistence is. You know, nobody wanted to touch the issue, so nothing got done, and the natives in 66 became very, very much politically involved, and it became an issue in the 66 election. And Hickel was elected because of his promise that he would address the issue. And we didn't get a satisfactory answer. I will.
So Hickel said he would address, yeah.
Yeah, so as a result, Hickel got somewhere between 40 and 60% of the native vote, which traditionally was like 90-plus percent Democrat.
Yeah.
And it elected him. He wouldn't have made it otherwise. Then he appoints Burr as his attorney general, and Burr is Anchorage, and Burr, nice guy, but...
Was Anchorage anti-Native Claims?
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, during the Native Claims movement, I used to meet regularly and work regularly with the Fairbanks Chamber. We got the Fairbanks Chamber to endorse the Native Claims movement. We could never get the Anchorage Chamber to endorse it.
What about Juneau?
Same way as Anchorage, basically.
Yeah.
But I think Juneau could have been turned around if there had been somebody working with the Juneau Chamber.
Roger Conner wasn't working with the Juneau Chamber?
At that time, he was in Anchorage, practicing law in Anchorage.
But he was
also, yeah.
And the Pauls wouldn't work with the...
No.
So what happened under Hickel?
Well,
were there any establishment Juneau people working for Native cause at all?
There probably were, but I can't now recall any.
And Gro and McCutcheon were the ones in Anchorage.
Gro and McCutcheon were the ones in Anchorage.
And Roger and Connor, if he was there.
Except that Les Miller and Roger Connor got involved fairly early.
So did you...
Another one got involved was a San Francisco attorney. Oh my God, I was thinking about that. Modern Trials by Belli. Belli got involved. I don't know how he got involved, but somebody managed to get him involved, and yes, he was involved.
Who brought him in? Do you have any idea?
Talk to Tallman. Ask Tallman. Tallman may know. Or Tallman may have brought him in.
Was Tallman involved at all?
Tallman was in, yeah. Yes, he was.
So which state is?
My impression is Lime Hills, or somewhere down in South Central area. But who, I can't recall for sure now. He didn't do very much.
When was your...
He had sort of the same relationship on a person-to-person basis as McCutcheon did. But McCutcheon did the work and Tallman didn't.
Were there any other people in Fairbanks working for Native causes? Any
no.
other lawyers?
Well, Mary Alice Miller took it. You know, I went back to the legislature and... Oh, God.
I
got out. I'm not sure of the elections, you know. My timing may be wrong. It may have been the 68 election instead of 66 that they went to heckle. But at any rate, at some point, I felt that I had a conflict of interest. And so I asked Mary Alice Miller to take the case over. And so Mary Alice Miller represented them for, yeah, that was around 66, 67.
Was the conflict because you were in the legislature?
Because I felt that I had a conflict of interest. And she represented them for a year. And Collins and Clasby had had them before me because at that time, Ted was in the firm of Collins and Clasby.
How long was Stevens in the Collins and Clasby firm?
He left by the time I arrived in February of 68.
Was Collins?
I mean, 58.
Did Collins and Clasby have any of these DEFCA?
No idea. I've got no idea.
Because they're an old establishment.